Welcome to Oncology Today, first line and maintenance therapy for patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and I'm joined today by Professor Sibylla Leubel from the German Breast Group and Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, to discuss treatment options for patients with HER2-positive metastatic disease. To begin, I asked Professor Leubel to comment on the gains in median overall survival that have been observed over the past few years in metastatic breast cancer, beginning with patients with HER2-positive disease.
I think it's the consequence and multitude of treatment we have. I think first we saw treatment beyond progression helps. We have introduced that as a concept. Then we have used treatment beyond progression across multiple lines of therapy. So we never stop the anti-HER2 treatment. We might change it, but we never stop it. And then we have seen also the ADCs like T-DM1 also improve the treatment. And we have seen lapatinib, we have neratinib, we have now T-DXd, tucatinib. And I think these treatment options, the patients have really prolonged their overall survival in the end and the consequent therapy.
So the real question I wanted to ask you about this, that was sort of preliminary, and this is an issue we're getting into more and more in oncology and all different tumor types, which is the issue of, quote, the tail on the curve. And you kind of alluded to that a little bit in your talk when you were talking about TCHP. But right now, when you look at these four subsets and you see a patient who's presenting today, first-line therapy of metastatic disease, in your mind, and I'm sure a lot of patients ask you, what's the likelihood or the possibility that they're going to be doing well, maybe free of disease at 5 years, maybe even cured?
Well, that's a good question. If they are cured and free of disease, this is very rare. I mean, we have seen a complete response rate in the DB09 study of 8% with THP and 16%, if I remember correctly, with T-DXd plus P. So it's good, but it's not perfect, and we don't see many complete responses further down the line. I think it depends very much on how many metastases you have and if you have de novo real metastatic. And then we see patients who really remain free of disease for a very, very long time. And then you always question yourself, do you stop the anti-HER2 treatment or should you continue?
Well, you know, also there's the concept, you know, sort of from CML that you might need to be treated, but if you live as long as people, you know, who don't have cancer, it's sort of a functional cure. And again, when you think about HER2 positive in general, triple negative in general, and ER positive, all metastatic disease, in your mind, what's the chance that they will live, you know, a normal lifespan without any more clinical problems with cancer? If the patient asks you to give them a number or an estimate.
I've never asked myself that question, really. But it's a good question. Free of, I think it's about 5%. It's not
really?
Nil. I don't think it's higher.
HER2 positive.
Yeah, HER2 positive, I think 5 to maximum 10%, not more. Yeah.
What about ER positive, HER2 negative? Zero?
I would say about the same. The complete response rate is about the same. It's slightly higher in the ER negative HER2 positive, the complete response rate. And I think we need to look at the complete response rate because those are the patients who have the highest likelihood of remaining free of disease.
So, of course, I want to get into the clinical interpretation of DB09 and also the HER-CLIMB and PATINA trials in terms of what your thoughts are, you know, in terms of clinical practice. But one other sort of theoretical point, which is we continue to wait in DB09 for the TDX arm, TDXD alone arm. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, I kind of became a little bit of a pertuzumab skeptic with the affinity data. But then when I look back in your presentation and I think about Cleopatra, that was an incredible endorsement for pertuzumab. But how critical do you think pertuzumab is? And I've heard people say they're getting kind of suspicious that they're not seeing the TDXD arm alone, that maybe it's going to be negative. Any thoughts?
I think we need pertuzumab. That's my personal interpretation. I cannot believe that we won't see any effect. And if I see the DB11 data, well, it's early, and affinity is early, Cleopatra is metastatic. But I think we see an effect of pertuzumab, especially we have, since in that trial, so few patients have received pertuzumab before. So I think we will see an effect of pertuzumab in the study.
Every time I see DB09 presented, I learn more about it. I mean, it's obvious stuff, but I was really kind of shocked when you were explaining prior treatment. Because, of course, the de novo patients, they're going to be the same. But when people have had prior treatment, I think, often nowadays they've had, pertuzumab, trastuzumab, chemotherapy, and most of the DB09 patients did not, correct?
Correct, yeah. Yeah. They did not. 80% had chemo, at least. So I think it's a global trial, and in those trial patients have no access to pertuzumab. They don't have access to T-DM1, so they just received mainly, if at all, trastuzumab. And for them, the chance to be entered into such a trial is a huge chance to improve outcome. And so that's why crossover is a little, because crossover, again, they don't have access to the treatment in general practice.
I'm just thinking, maybe you went through this, the benefit in DB09, whether it was de novo or not. Same?
The relative benefit was the same. Of course, DBO, the de novo patients are on a higher level than the metastatic patients in general. That's always the case. But the relative benefit is the same. There is no subgroup. We could not identify any subgroup where there is a difference.
And do you think that, I imagine there are going to be real-world studies and who knows what else, but do you think when it finally gets fleshed out, people who've gotten prior, neoadjuvant chemo, HP, are going to have the same kind of benefit that we're seeing here?
I think it depends very much on when they relapse. When they relapse early, probably the effect is a little less. When they relapse late, then the effect is probably the same. I mean, the same argument was discussed a lot when we first saw the Cleopatra trial, because so few patients had received trastuzumab before as part of the early breast cancer treatment. And still we use the Cleopatra regimen THP also in patients who have received THP as part of the adjuvant therapy.
So again, a couple more questions about the data as it relates to endocrine treatment. First is really, I have noticed before in DB09 how little endocrine therapy or endocrine maintenance was used. I'm not sure. I've heard people speculate that that may be representative of what's been going on, at least until Patina came out. Any thoughts about do you think that hormonal therapy is as important in HER2 positive as it is in HER2 negative?
Yes, I think so. And we know that HER2 positive, hormone receptor positive disease is much more heterogeneous. And so part of the heterogeneity, not all, but part of it is the HER2 positivity. And I think it's important. It's probably a little bit overlaid because HER2 is more important than ER for achieving a response. But for maintaining the response and for the long-term benefit, ER is very important. We saw that in the affinity trial. We didn't see any benefit when we first read out the trial in the hormone receptor positive subgroup. But in the long run, we see a larger relative benefit in the hormone receptor positive subgroup. And they all received 5 years of endocrine treatment. There is an interaction between the ER pathway and the HER2 pathway. And I think we need ER treatment.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I love asking people, like, what's the connection between ER and HER2? And, people talk about crosstalk. I'm not sure what that means, but in terms of endocrine therapy and HER2-positive patients, you know, one of the things I thought was very striking was the difference in post-adjuvant neratinib, where you saw a really positive effect in ER-positive and not in ER-negative. Any sort of theme that would explain the neratinib findings and all the other findings with ER and HER2 other than crosstalk, although I'm not sure what that actually means?
I think, I mean, you can easily say it's you target both streams and we have micromets, and if you target ER and if you target HER2 together, it might be even more effective. We stop the treatment and we haven't seen an improvement in the HERA trial when we give it for 2 years instead of just 1 year, but maybe changing it to a TKI, which works differently, and there might be another interaction crosstalk whatsoever in the cellular level when a TKI is given. And there are other examples of that, but the TKIs have not been so deeply investigated as the antibodies, but they work, and they work really well and probably especially good in the ER-positive subgroup.
Another thing that you got into in your talk is the issue of PIK3 mutations in HER2-positive disease. And I'm curious, you mentioned the prognostic issue. Is it enough of a prognostic factor that you think it ought to be looked at? It didn't look that dramatically different, but do you think it ought to be, it'd be good to know that when you take care of a patient? And any thoughts about targeting the PIK3 pathway? Obviously, we have PIK3 inhibitors, but also there was some work done in colon cancer with PIK3 where they used mini-dose aspirin and seemed to see an effect. So again, do you think PIK3 is a practical biomarker that maybe ought to be looked at? And any thoughts about aspirin or AKT inhibition outside of ER-positive, HER2-positive, even triple-negative? I've heard cases like that.
So, I mean, looking at it, I think makes sense. It's a mutation, and it's a targetable mutation, and we have now drugs which become even more and more effective, more and more tolerable, and there are clinical trials running in the subset of HER2-positive patients with a PI3 kinase mutation. So I'm a big fan of target the target, and I think that's why we see such an improvement in the ER-positive, HER2-positive, and if we would target the PI3 kinase mutation, we would see even further improvement. We are currently running in the GBG a study in the neoadjuvant setting with ER treatment, dual blockade, with or without a PI3 kinase inhibitor in the subset of patients triple positive with a PI3 kinase mutation. And I think it's kind of a proof of concept study if that could improve the outcome further. Since they have a bad prognosis, we might improve this prognosis a bit.
You're using an AKT inhibitor?
We are using a TKI inhibitor.
Of AKT?
Of a PI3 kinase inhibitor. So AKT they differentiate inhibitors and PI3 kinase inhibitors. So,
and is it an available inhibitor? Or
we are using inavolisib. I mean, this is not, I mean, you can read that up, and we are presenting some safety data at ESMO Breast now. It's inavolisib, and well, it's when we started the trial, it was not available, but now it's approved and you can use it. But it's, of course, not approved for this subset of patients.
Yeah, no, I mean, inavolisib has a pretty significant effect in ER-positive disease. It's major. Yeah, yeah. So if it had anything like that in HER2, it would be very helpful. All right, let's get into the big questions of the day, like what do you do in practice? So let's just put aside regulatory issues and assume you can do whatever you want. So I guess the first question would be, who are the patients who you wouldn't give T-DXd to? Or I could say, who would you give it to? But why don't we just start out with, like, in what situations would you not use T-DXd right now?
Well, I'm probably only in patients who are really frail, old, had a relapse after maybe 10 years or so. Otherwise, I mean, we entered all the patients we could into the trial, so why shouldn't we give the treatment to all patients we can in the first-line setting?
So what about people with prior pulmonary issues? How much of a pulmonary problem would they, if let's say they're younger, 50, 60 years old, but they have some kind of pulmonary condition. What kind of pulmonary conditions would you say, hey, I don't think we ought to use T-DXd?
Well, this is a good question. Of course, we need to check for any pulmonary issues. And if they have kind of a pneumonitis, which is already pre-present, I wouldn't give it to the patient. But any other lung disease, I think we can give it.
And in terms of patients being frail or older or comorbidities, it also gets into tolerance issues. So, particularly acute GI toxicity. And I'm curious, I always loved it, now the TDXD is getting out to GI, GYN, et cetera, GU. They're trying to figure out what to do, and they always ask the breast people. And of course, this is an issue not just in first-line therapy, but anytime you use TDXD. First of all, in general, how much of an issue do you think acute GI chemo-like toxicity is with TDXD? What's your specific approach to preemptive management of it?
Well, GI in terms of nausea and vomiting, I mean, if you mean that, I would give some sort of a pre-supportive drug to avoid that completely, because the treatment is given for a long time and we want to stay the patient on the treatment. So it makes sense to apply a three-drug combination or a two-drug combination. We usually use a three-drug combination to prevent this, because this is the anxiety of the most patients. And we are both old enough to remember the cisplatin area where every patient has vomiting. And this was the angst comes from chemotherapy, is because they had so strong nausea and vomiting, nothing could be done. And I think that's why we need to absolutely avoid that. We can avoid that, and we must avoid it. That's why we should give supportive treatment.
I was just flashing the fact we love to present real cases. I was just remembering that at San Antonio, we actually had a case presented of a 103-year-old woman who was living by herself, taking care of herself, and had metastatic disease, wanted to be treated. I mean, she just got a cert and all, but it is kind of a reminder that sort of age may be a little bit of an issue. But you, if you have a very elderly patient, let's say 90, maybe that's more realistic, and they say to you, okay, you have all these preemptive meds you're going to give me, but bottom line is, how's it going to be? Am I still going to be sick, or do you think I'll be totally fine?
I think they will be fine. Because nausea and vomiting, this is not the issue. And I know some of my colleagues start with a lower dose to make it better tolerable for the patients, and especially for the elderly patients. And if someone is otherwise healthy, ECOG 01 lives by itself and wants to be treated, why not treat her? I mean, she will live for a couple of more years, and we treat her, of course.
So another question that's been interesting to see as TDXD gets out, it's interesting because the general oncologist has a lot more experience with TDXD than the GI people or the GYN. And one of the issues that obviously comes up all the time is preemptive screening imaging with TDXD. Mm-hmm. What's your usual approach? I don't know if you're constrained by, reimbursement or what do you think is the ideal approach to screening for ILD in terms of imaging or any other modality?
Well, I mean, there are guidelines how often to do that at baseline, and then every 6 weeks and every 6 weeks, and then you can increase the interval to 3 monthly. And I think we should follow that, because, I mean, we can lose patients with an ILD. This is a potential lethal toxicity, which we absolutely need to avoid. And when we saw the first data on TDXD, the death rate was quite high, and there was not a lot of enthusiasm about the drug because so many patients were dying. So I think we need to be careful, and I think every doctor has lost the patient on ILD, because in earlier years we were using more bleomycin and so on and so forth. I think we don't want that. It's not a nice. We shouldn't. We must absolutely avoid death on treatment due to toxicity. That's my opinion.
What do you think is the ideal approach to the concept of rechallenge with TDXD? Mm. I guess particularly since last year's ASCO, I hear a lot of people saying they will consider a rechallenge in patient with grade one who recovers completely, but they stop with grade two. Do you subscribe to that approach? And is that your approach in the first line setting as well? If you have grade one ILD and they recover, will you go back to TDXD?
It depends very much on how they responded. If they had a beautiful response, close to a complete response, well, I would consider rechallenging it. It depends on the age of the patient. It depends on how long they needed to recover, how bad it was. You can rechallenge maybe with a lower dose. That's what some people do, and then they increase. It's still an individual decision because this was not foreseen in the clinical trials. So we'll still have only a few cases in every hospital where we can look at the rechallenge where it worked. And so still need to be careful here.
So I think from the day that Sarah Tolaney presented the DB09 study, the main question that's been out there is for how long? Because we got used to using maintenance therapy with TCHP. A lot of people have been saying since then that what they want to do or are doing is not to use it indefinitely, although I'm not sure. I don't know how often you see people who just sail right through it, have no problems, whether you might consider continuing there. I know we don't really have the data we like to have, but for practical purposes, what do you think is the most reasonable approach right now to how long for TDXD, including how long if the patient's doing great?
Well, as long as the patient tolerates the treatment, we give it, because that's how it was done in the trial. We need to await the data where they stop with six cycles of TDXD and then switch to maintenance. This might be an approach, but we don't have randomized data. We probably will not have randomized data for that question. Can we stop TDXD at best response and then continue with HP, or do we really need to continue throughout? Probably in 2 years' time when we see the data, we might, and we have seen more maintenance therapy studies which are coming up, then we probably switch after a while. But this is always discussed with a patient, because currently we continue until progression.
So you said, you know, theoretically, if they're tolerating it well, to continue it. Mm-hmm. I kind of get the feeling that, you know, we don't do consensus conference. We ask like 20 people, you know, investigators, what they do. And then if they all do the same thing, that means something. And then if they do four different things, that means something too. I've had the feeling, you know, that a lot of people are thinking about preemptively stopping, even if people are tolerating it well. But from your point of view, when you say assuming they're tolerate, like how much of a problem would it be if the patient just wasn't even having the symptoms, but they were getting tired of coming into clinic? Would that be a reason to switch? Like, what's your trigger? And do you think it's reasonable to at least present to the patient the possibility of going to maintenance, even if they're tolerating it well?
I think certainly it's an option, and we can discuss that with a patient. And I think not wanting to come to the clinic is a very strong and very good reason, because it's part of the quality of life. And this is something which is the disease bothering you. Yes. I mean, HP can be given as sub-Q, endocrine treatment can be swallowed as a pill. So they can do that at home. They don't need to come to the clinic, but for TDXD, they have to come. What I could also imagine will happen, if the patient wants to go on holidays, they will be put on HP for a while. And then if they come back, they continue with TDXD if they have not progressed. I think in future, we will become much more flexible with using the drugs according to the patient's need.
Yeah, you see that in other areas of oncology, you know, CLL, for example, prostate cancer, you know, sort of treatment holidays, et cetera. So it's not a new concept in oncology.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about maintenance, assuming you want to stop the TDXD, or whether it's temporary or indefinite, and you're thinking about maintenance. And obviously, HP is on it would be sort of the basic, but the question is, what do you add on to it? You brought up sort of an algorithm that we're hearing a lot, which is ER positive, palbo, ER negative to tucatinib. What about, first of all, a combination of palbo and tucatinib? Has that been looked at? Do you think we could end up in that place?
Interesting question. I haven't thought of that, to be honest. Of course, you could exchange tucatinib pertuzumab by tucatinib. So you give trastuzumab, tucatinib, and palbo. Well, you need to try it out for the toxicity. The triplet plus palbo probably could be too toxic because of diarrhea and stomatitis. But I haven't tried it out yet. So this is a four drug combination then, actually a quadro of, what's that? Five drugs. So with endocrine therapy, it's probably a bit too much, but, we can exchange pertuzumab with tucatinib.
We got myeloma out there, you know, four or five drugs there all day. But
yeah, that's
getting
true.
Back to the, getting back to not necessarily, that's not necessarily a good thing, but getting back to, again, whether or not to go to maintenance. When you said that, you know, if the patient's tolerating T-DXd well, doesn't mind coming into clinic, you would continue it. I'm kind of curious, like, say after six cycles, what fraction of people fall into that category? They're tolerating well, we no problem continuing.
On the majority, I would say 70%, you would continue.
At what point do you think you start to see more problems? After how long?
Well, we know that ILD starts around seven cycles, the rate is increasing. So I think this is a sort of a tipping point, and 6 months is, 6 cycles is about 5 months treatment. So, well, 6, 7, 8 month therapy, I think it's a long time for continuous treatment and being bound to a place, being less flexible, yeah. If the data will be good, it will be done.
I want to try to explore a little bit more about sort of the realities of making these decisions in clinical practice, and maybe hear a little bit about some of your patients, you know, that you've taken care of, you know, particularly the issue of individualizing the decision. We know that in oncology, there's many, many decisions that you certainly can involve the patient in if they want to be involved, but, you know, there's not a clear-cut answer. So you were telling me you had a patient recently that you evaluated for first-line therapy. What happened there?
Well, she was is a very young patient. We just discussed it 2 days back. She was about 40 years old and relapsed after 2 years after her completing her neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy in HER2-positive disease. She had a PCR or near PCR with just one lymph node involved, and she had hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive disease, and she would be a very good candidate for T-DXd plus B with a liver mets and being young and having not such a very long treatment-free interval. I think she would be a perfect candidate to start it out, and was of course with 40 in a very good condition.
Curious about her life situation. Does she have children? Does she have small children? What's her attitude about treatment? Is she concerned about side effects or more about trying to get the best possible outcome?
She wants the best possible outcome. She has small children still, I mean small teens, but she still wants to have the best outcome. She wants to live.
It's interesting, too, that she had a PATH CR. I've always wondered why, I mean, people with PATH CRs do relapse. I always wondered why that maybe had, maybe it statistically would be hard to do, but any thoughts about whether cell-free DNA would ever have a role in breast cancer in general, including in a post-neoadjuvant setting like she faced? For example, if she'd had a positive cell-free DNA after all that treatment.
I mean, we have done this analysis and looked into PCR patients. Who are the PCR patients who relapse? And these are the patients with large tumors and high nodal involvement. They do worse. I mean, you carry your biology risk with you, if regardless of PCR or no PCR. And those PCR patients do worse. And therefore, I think we need to be careful here. These patients could be good candidates for cell-free DNA. to monitor them more closely, to start early if we see a real benefit of starting treatment very early. Because then if you're only reducing the treatment-free interval for such a patient but don't improve the overall survival in the end, then it doesn't make sense to monitor them with C-free DNA.
Getting back to your patient, do you think that if she could get T-DXd, do you think she'd want to continue it as long as possible? Or do you think at some point she would fail? I mean, she has ER-positive disease. I assume you would, if you could, you would add palbo to it. How would you present maintenance to her if she was continuing to tolerate it well?
I think some sort of maintenance concept or the possibility of it can be discussed already prior to the start of the treatment, because I think we need to give the whole information to the patient or the whole possibility you can treat with the same drug until progression with T-DXd plus P. But for THB, we never could treat until progression because we always had to stop the chemotherapy because it's not tolerable. That's why this maintenance treatment came up at all. Probably we wouldn't have called that a maintenance therapy if we wouldn't have added something on top like tucatinib or palbo. But in this setting, I guess, because we did that in Cleopatra, we stopped the chemo and continued with HP. Did we call it maintenance? No, we did not. It was part of the treatment algorithm. But of course, if we change now from T-DXd plus P to HP plus endocrine treatment plus plus, then it's a different treatment concept. And that's why I think we need to present it to, because a patient with children, she wants to go on holidays, she wants to have a little bit of more freedom. That's why we should introduce her the possibility that we can stop if we reach the best, or for a while or forever, and then we can continue with maintenance therapy, and when it comes back we can restart. I think this is a much better concept than say, well, now we treat you forever with T-DXd plus P, and we see you every 3 weeks in clinic, and in between you go for your blood test and so on and so forth.
I'm guessing or assuming this lady might be premenopausal. Are you thinking about ovarian suppression for her?
Not necessarily. Because the main driver, and we had that before, is still HER2. ER is important, but I'm not aware of having seen any data, not even in the soft intake of the early breast cancer patient, that the GnRH analog is so important for those patients. So a tamoxifen, or of course, if you use an AI. And probably T-DXd has some sort of ovarian function suppression as well. So we need to test for that. And then she gets either an AI alone or an AI with GnRH or a tamoxifen. So it depends a little what she had received before.
I'm guessing in general you use ovarian suppression or ablation in ER-positive patients and HER2-negative. But you don't seem as convinced. Again, I'm thinking about this young woman with the children and all, trying to do everything she can, whether or not, I mean, if she's going to get hormonal therapy, I mean, unless you give her tamoxifen, would you consider just tamoxifen, or would you give her palbo and tamoxifen?
As maintenance, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why not? I mean, palbo, tamoxifen, you can combine the two drugs. It's no problem. This is the flexibility with palbo, that you can combine it with tamoxifen. You don't necessarily need to add a GnRH. You need to add a GnRH if you use an AI, for sure. But we need to test the ovarian function. I haven't seen any data yet on the ovarian function suppression capability of T-DXd. There will be data. We just need to check that out.
So I'm kind of thinking back to the beginning of our conversation, talking about tail on the curve. And, you know, one of the issues with, because we are seeing this, you know, in other areas, particularly with immune therapy, whether it's checkpoint inhibitors, bispecifics, CAR T, et cetera. And even though we have increasing number of effective treatments in breast cancer, it kind of looks like we're still not getting very much of a tail on the curve type effect. And again, you know, you think about a patient who might relapse after T-DXd, even in terms of what might be next. Anything on the horizon that you're excited about in breast cancer in general, but particularly in HER2-positive disease, particularly in the immune area? I know, you know, it's been disappointing in terms of checkpoint inhibitors, but there are other kinds of therapy, as I said, bispecifics, CAR-T. Any thoughts about whether, you know, there's something else out there that could give the tail of the curve more of a bump?
Well, certainly with immune therapy, there is a tail on the curve in triple-negative breast cancer. Early triple-negative breast cancer, there is, but it's also the nature of the disease. After 5 years, that not much is happening. So we need to differentiate that from the metastatic breast cancer. We see some sort of a tail in the curve, and we see a bit of a tail in the curve, although it's on very low bottom in HER2-positive disease. Probably the bispecific have a chance to do that, but I think it's sort of how long can we give the treatment, and the longer we can give the treatment, the better we see the tail on the curve, or have the possibility to see the tail in the curve.
So another question I wanted to ask you is, and kind of getting outside of choosing anti-tumor therapy, but our bonding with patients, interaction with patients, I'm thinking about this woman you described having gone through neoadjuvant therapy and, you know, surgery, et cetera, et cetera. I can imagine it was a terrible, terrible day when she was diagnosed with metastatic disease. I'm kind of curious how you and your team there deal with patients in this type of situation.
Well, I mean, they come already with some sort of either symptoms, or they have been some sort of pre-diagnosis, because you don't routinely do a liver MRI as a routine follow-up treatment. So she had already some sort of symptoms when she came. So this is then the patient is much better prepared already. But of course, it's always a shock for the patients, because what you lose the last is the hope that there is nothing. And you always feel that, of course, you will be cured, because so many patients are cured. The majority of patients is cured. And I have heard a patient last week at another meeting, and she said, damn, the last 10%, we will make it. But if you are in the 10% relapse, then you are the 10%. But the majority, of course, we have to keep that in mind, are not. But if you are, and especially the very young women, they have a higher risk. We know that, especially when they're hormone receptor positive, then we need to deal with them carefully. We need to explain this is not the end. We know today that you will live very long. You will see your children growing up. New treatments will come up. Look at the last 10 years, how many new treatment options we have seen. And there are so many positive cases where patients have been treated in clinical trials, have been using the modern technologies of characterizing the tumor even better, looking at the mutations, targeting the mutations, and they live for 10, 20 years and more. So I think it's not the end of your life, and you need to give hope. And this is what we can do, because we have seen so many new things coming up. And this is for those patients, to see them growing up, their children.
In terms of this overall topic of first-line therapy and maintenance of metastatic first-line therapy, any questions that come up or topics related to that we haven't talked about today that you'd like to comment on?
Man, it's always about toxicity. Of course, we haven't touched much on the toxicity, but your audience, they are all experienced oncologists. That's why I've kind of left it out a bit aside. You said they have probably more experience with T-DXd than I do, because I'm only seeing breast cancer patients, and we have many more areas where we use those drugs. And of course, we can deal with the toxicity, but of course, we need to be aware that pertuzumab adding to the T-DXd has more side effects than T-DXd alone. We see a higher rate of diarrhea. We see a higher rate of stomatitis. And of course, we need to be aware of that.
Yeah. How often do you see diarrhea as a problem that, you know, leads to, you know, dose reduction or halting? You know, how much of a problem is pertuzumab when combined with T-DXd?
It is a problem. I mean, it significantly increases the diarrhea rate. I mean, can feel and see that. And the problem is not the grade one, but also already grade two is an issue for the patients. And so we need to make them aware. We also need to tell them that with nutrition, you can mitigate the issue a little bit. But of course, we then try to reduce the dose first, or if it's very bad, then we stop the treatment and wait until it has improved.
So we just have a couple of minutes left. If I could, I want to do a little bit of a mini journal club on a couple of papers you did that I was curious about. So one from the European Journal of Cancer, body mass index and weight changes in patients with HER2-positive early breast cancer from the AFFINITY trial. It said that they did worse if they gained weight, and it was from 2025.
In general, but in general, the HER2 response is the same. I think there was an earlier paper on that, but in general, if they gain weight, all patients do worse, especially if they have hormone receptor-positive disease.
Yeah, I was curious because, you know, we were talking the other day. You may have seen this incredible adjuvant colon cancer paper this past year on exercise that reduced the recurrence rate. Randomized trial of 3 or 4 hours of exercise. I'm curious whether you think exercise, diet, GLP drugs, et cetera, has any role in management of breast cancer, including metastatic disease.
So we looked mainly in the early breast cancer, and of course the data are conflicting because they never do it properly, but I'm pretty much convinced that exercise and low-carb diet and reducing weight will help, because we know that this is inducing breast cancer, so it will help in the long run to avoid a relapse. Although the effect might be not that big, but there will be an effect. And if the patient asks me, what can I do? And I say, well, you can do something for you. You can do exercise and try to lose weight. I know it's not easy, but it will help you in the end, because it can also reduce your other side effects. It would help the joints. It would help the cardiovascular risk and so on and so forth.
Another paper, this is from NPI breast cancer, 2025, effects of pregnancy on breast cancer immunology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so breast cancer and pregnancy, this is one of my core topics. So we thought that we will see something in the tumor, a difference between the pregnant and non-pregnant patients. So we didn't see a lot. We saw a little bit of difference in Nectin-4. We didn't see anything in the TILs and in the other immune markers. So this was a bit interesting, because I think pregnancy is a different immune environment, but this was the tumor microenvironment. What we did not look at, because this is a retrospective analysis, is the humoral immune and this effect on the tumor.
Of course, the other thing is there are a lot of endocrine train changes in pregnancy. What do we know about the impact on let's say, an existing tumor based on the endocrine changes in pregnancy?
So the existing tumor, so if a patient is diagnosed with breast cancer during pregnancy and we treat the patient, then they have not a worse outcome. But what we also know, if a patient is diagnosed after the delivery, within the first year of delivery, then they have a worse outcome. And this has something to do with the local immune environment, angiogenesis, and there are pretty good data. And that's why we need to differentiate the patients who have got a breast cancer during pregnancy and are treated, and those who have been diagnosed thereafter. So sometimes I feel a little bit that usually the pregnant status is like of a hyperestrogen status, and it's kind of protective in general. Like, we can treat breast cancer with high doses of estrogen. We won't tolerate that very much, but we can do that, and we have data on that. But then after the pregnancy, everything is kind of reversed. We have a low status and the immune changes and the local immune situation changes. And epidemiological data in general suggests that the highest rate or the highest risk of getting pregnant breast cancer is actually within the couple of years after delivery, epidemiologically. But so we need to take that a little bit into account.
That's a great point about the high estrogens. I was just flashing on the fact that I think the original tamoxifen study was tamoxifen against DES, high dose estrogen. Yeah. And I think the efficacy was the same, but the toxicity obviously was a lot worse. But you're right, it does work. So one final question. Any thoughts, I know with your interest in pregnancy, about the positive trial in pregnancy that looks at holding off on endocrine treatment and allowing women the opportunity to conceive? Is that a strategy you use in your practice?
Yeah, very much, even before the study. So the main message is you can do it. Treat as long as you can before you interrupt endocrine treatment and resume the endocrine therapy thereafter. This is important. Don't stop. Resume and then continue.
Subsequent to the recording of this program, the FDA granted approval to palbociclib in combination with trastuzumab, with or without pertuzumab and endocrine therapy, for maintenance treatment of adults with HR-positive, HER2-positive, locally advanced or metastatic breast cancer following induction treatment based on the results of the Phase 3 PATINA trial. This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. The use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed, so check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Loibel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today, first line and maintenance therapy for patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer.